from Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
يا فلسطينية يا مام وين الهوى يا مام وين الهوى Welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Asa Wynn-Stanley, and we have a fantastic episode for you today.
Yeah, we've just filmed an interview about with two Palestinian doctors, medical doctors, it went really well, I think. Nora, how do you think it went?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, so when we talk about, Israel's vaccine apartheid, which is happening right now, and has been, you know, Israel denying Palestinians under its military occupation access to the vaccines and blaming them for their own health outcomes. Of course, Israel being the occupying power and obliged to follow the Geneva Conventions and all international laws that pertain. It's important to really expose Israel for what it is. And, you'll hear Dr. Khada Karmi talk about the, how important it is to understand Israel as a colonial apartheid state. And so everything that Israel says it's doing, we're a vaccine leader, we are the startup nation, using all this wonderful technology to inoculate our citizens. It's important to understand that is a essential public relations campaign meant to distract the world from the crimes that Israel takes part in every day as a settler colony state.
Yeah, it's like when South Africa used to say that it was sort of bringing civilization to Africa, right? Because
people are so much better off, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the apartheid white supremacist government of South Africa, presented itself as this bulwark against communism and, as outpost of civilization amongst the so-called savages. And Israel portrays itself in very much the same way. Yeah. And its attitude towards the vaccine is another illustration of that, and it's a really stark illustration of Israeli apartheid. And it's former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, from the supposedly left-wing Israeli Labour Party, used to refer to Israel as a villa in the jungle, right. So presumably, in this analogy, the Arabs are these wild animals or, naked savages amongst this sort of colonial villa in the jungle, and that's right. Israel.
Right, and that's been normalized, that shockingly racist, just disgusting colonial, smear campaign against Palestinians is very normal.
It's a really, it has opened a lot of people's eyes, think. I mean, you'll see, you'll see in the interview now, with Dr. Rada talking about how Israel is still not held accountable for these crimes and does get away with all these things and what we need to do to try and change that. Yeah. But I think on the popular level, this situation is really stark. You've got a situation where Israel claims, we're occupying all our citizens. We're vaccinating all our citizens. But the reality is that, you've got about roughly 6 million Israeli Jews and, roughly 6.5 million Palestinian Arabs living in historic Palestine between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. Roughly more or less equal in terms of population numbers. Maybe a little more on the Palestinian side. It's a little bit uncertain the exact figures because these are obfuscated by the Israeli regime. But more or less it's roughly 50-50. And yet 5 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the vast majority of Palestinians have absolutely no entitlement to vaccines from the government that rules their destinies, the Israeli government, the Israeli occupation government. Right. And it's a really stark illustration of what we mean when we say apartheid.
I'm really excited that we also got to talk to Dr. Osama Tanous. He's a physician based in Haifa. And he talks about the machinations of Israel's apartheid in vaccine apartheid, medical apartheid, and how it also furthers the settler colonial state, and it just absolutely essential analysis from both Dr. Rada and Dr. Osama. Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman in California.
And I'm Mason Winstanley in London.
And let's get right into it. Today we're going to be talking about Israel's vaccine apartheid and how occupation and colonialism impacts not just COVID-19 outcomes for Palestinians under occupation, but public health in Palestine overall. Joining us are two physicians, writers, and experts on public health in Palestine, Dr. Osama Tanous, joining us from Atlanta, and Dr. Khada Karmi in London. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having us.
So let's start with you, Osama. If you could talk about the facts on the ground in Palestine right now, what does it mean to have 5 million Palestinians under occupation, blocked from getting the vaccine by Israel, while Israel is sending, for example, this week it was revealed, Israel is sending other countries extra vaccines of theirs in exchange for political support. What does the, paint us a picture of what it looks like right now.
Yeah, thank you, Noura. Well, yeah, I think when you ask about Palestine, it's another opportunity to remind our audience that Palestine is a fragmented geographical unit, right? And this really correlates to the whole entire crisis that, you know, when you want to try to define where is the occupied Palestinian territories, where is Israel, where does this start and where does this end? It's all basically, you know, we need to remember that that geography and that fragmented geography has been created by the colonial expansion, right? By frontier colonial expansion. So you have, you know, Gaza, which is also an artificially created piece of land, created and bordered by the Israeli, you know, expansion in 1948, also the West Bank. And then you have settlements inside the West Bank that kind of have Israeli sovereignty on them and connected to them. Versus the rest of the West Bank that is an entirely fragmented also geographical piece without sovereignty on the land, right? So what we see as Palestine and Israel-Palestine is a very fragmented geography with a different healthcare system. So while the Israeli healthcare system is a kind of strong, developed, well-established, also, you know, to remember that that started before 48. It started as a settler colonial infrastructure to support the colonization of Palestine. And then it really had, you know, sovereignty on the ground, had funding and good planning and so on. The Palestinian healthcare system, generally, as of the rest of everything in the occupied Palestinian territory, was a product of occupation, of not having sovereignty on the plan, on the land, not having import-export, not being able to really conduct health policies. And this is why when we talk about healthcare in Palestine, we talk about a very fragmented and weak healthcare system that compromises also of governmental actors, of non-governmental organizations, of the UNRWA, of profit organization, and all of that in a chaotic, you know, mishmash of, you know, of different actors who work also on the ground. But you have different shades of accessibility, different kinds of insurances, you know, in Gaza, it's completely under siege. So also that weak healthcare system is under the control of Israel, basically, because it cannot import on export. And that is why you have such huge differences in the healthcare provision. But that also comes to emphasize that Israel is the has a legal duty to vaccinate the Palestinians. Israel is the occupying power, although you have the Palestinian Authority as a local governing body that kind of has some kind of limited authority in some places of Palestine. It is by no means the ruling body. The ruling body in all of Mandate Historical Palestine is the Israeli occupation. The vast majority of the West Bank is Area C, so it's under Israeli direct military control. And according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, the occupying power has the duty to provide healthcare to the people it occupies. That, of course, is paradoxical when we think about why would an occupier who occupies a population want to deliver healthcare? Why would it want its best if it's really trying to make it subhuman, to occupy it, to exploit it? That comes because occupation was never meant to be something that is long-lasting. Occupation was meant to be, you know, temporary, and that's why you have these laws to allow occupation to be non-sustainable and to be exhausting to the occupying power. This is not the case in Israel. Israel runs a kind of a very easy occupation that doesn't cost it a lot. To the contrary, it benefits it because it has a huge captive market of also workers and market that consume its good. And this is why, and from that, Israel is not fulfilling its duty of providing vaccination to the Palestinians. So if you want to see the facts on the ground, we can see a very well-oiled machine inside the 48 areas inside Israel that runs a massive vaccination campaign. Versus in the Palestinian territories, the occupied Palestinian territories that are dependent on Israeli permission, even for, you know, the entrance of COVID test, of vaccination, of whatnot, of the entire healthcare system, then you have a very chaotic. Also, we need to mention that the PA is being nothing but professional or transparent in that sense. So also how vaccinations are being distributed or to whom they are being distributed and what criteria and so on. Of course, the PA is not a good model for ruling, and it has never really paid much attention to the healthcare of its population. It has invested massively on security forces and so on. Of course, security that doesn't provide security to its population and has neglected healthcare. So you have very different landscapes if you're in Israel or Palestine. Yeah.
Osama, you've written for the Journal of Palestinian Studies last year about the public health emergency during the COVID-19 pandemic. You argued that, quote, the healthcare system, an essential pillar and infrastructural foundation of the settler colonial project, is naively imagined as an apolitical, neutral sphere. Throughout the process, settler militarism, settler symbols, and settler domination have continued to be normalized. Could you talk a little bit about that and about how Israel has taken advantage of the pandemic to further its own ends?
Yeah, definitely. I wrote that, you know, it was in the peak of the pandemic when Israel has completely militarized and securitized the pandemic. So you saw different actors. First of all, you know, in Israel, it's a heavy militarized country and heavy militarized state. So it's very hard to distinguish, you know, between the civil sphere and the military sphere, because everything, whether it's academia, healthcare, everything is very much militarized. But when the pandemic had, although Israel has a very, you know, as we say, sophisticated healthcare system, it really brought in different actors like the Israeli intelligence, the Shin Bet and the Mossad to kind of take over. And they were, you know, tracking the patients with COVID. They were sitting facilities for quarantine. And we saw a heavy militarization of the mobilization of the army into the hospitals and into the towns, you know, in order to provide the testing centers and vaccination. And this is incredibly, for the Israeli society, this is normal, because they are mostly, you know, you have obligatory military, they are part of the military and so on. For us Palestinians in that healthcare system, it was alarming, you know, to see the military becoming so normalized as a normal acting body, being it, you know, in our towns, inside the hospitals, where 20% or something of the physicians inside the Israeli hospitals are Palestinians inside, citizens of Israel, also regarding nursing and the entire staff. So in that, and what really struck me is that you had the, you know, Israel was kind of trying to celebrate its healthcare, and it was really celebrated in the New York Times, in Washington Post, how successful and beautiful this model is, where you have Palestinian and Israelis working hand in hand and so on. So like this, you know, united front. But that even was militarized. It was described as brothers in arms, you know, as if like the both of us are soldiers in the front line of. So the whole description of COVID and fighting COVID became completely militarized. And even Palestinian doctors starting using militarized jargon for describing themselves, you know, as like militant on the front. And that was like really alarming for me. And I really needed to state that how these processes, if you're not aware of them, they can really infiltrate you so slowly. And then they become normalized and hyper normalized. So it becomes completely normal seeing army inside the hospitals, seeing the army not as an occupying army, you know, but as an something, a normal actor in the management of the crisis. So it was really, important to stretch that out. And you had, it was really surprising, even for main physicians were kind of adapting these symbols quite normally.
Ghadar, I want to bring you in as well. Can you talk a little bit about the what you think about when you see the incredible Hasbara, the propaganda program that Israel has rolled out, that Osama just referred to, that it is, you know, the leading force of vaccinating its population, that it's really just top of the line. You know, it's kind of like the kind of tech washing of Israel as a startup nation, you know, all these innovations. Meanwhile, of course, Palestinians aren't able to get the vaccine. And that usually, you know, when the New York Times or Washington Post talks about it, it's usually at the very bottom of the story that, oh, yeah, by the way, Israel is not allowing Palestinians to access the vaccine. There was even a New York Times article in the last couple of days where the sub headline was critics say, what was it? It was, Israel gives vaccine to far off allies as Palestinians wait. And the subhead was critics say Israel has an obligation to inoculate Palestinians, as though international law was just like a critic of opinion. Talk about what you're seeing and what this says about Israel's, you know, colonialism at this point.
Yeah, look, the way to understand the vaccination story is the same way as one understands anything to do with Israel, politically. There is no other way to see it and to understand it. The context is political, and everything Israelis do has a political aim. And the vaccination is no different whatsoever. Because what's happened is that, as we've just heard very ably, I must say, from Osama, what's happened is that Israel is indeed a world leader. There's no question in the vaccination program for its own citizens, one has to stress. Mm-hmm. It's very far from that for the Palestinians. And what we have here is a classic example of apartheid in the medical sphere. The fact that Israel promotes this and has a very good, slick PR operation is not surprising. It's something which we've seen from Israel for decades. They just apply it to the same thing, only they apply it to a new field, whatever that might happen to be. The extraordinary thing about all this is that the facts, which are really shocking. The facts are shocking. The extraordinary thing is the way that it's accepted. It's accepted in the Western world as somehow that's the way things are. You pointed to the New York Times article. Of course, there are many, many more that accept the subtext behind Israel's success, i.e., they don't do anything for the people that they rule, the half of the people they rule, whom they have, they give nothing to, no rights, no nothing. What I think about it is that if you look at the facts, you see that Israel has offered the Palestinians a miserable 5,000 vaccine doses. And even that, barely. They held up in the last week, they've held up a consignment of vaccines from the Russians, of the Russian vaccine, held them up for 2 days, no reason why, they just spite. And the attitude to the Palestinians under their rule, I don't like the word occupation, they just simply rule them. Yeah. The Palestinians under their rule is one of clear apartheid. Now, we know that Palestinians are paying the price because nearly 200,000 cases have been reported in the Palestinian territory. Over 2,000 people have died from COVID. And that is striking. I tell you why, because the precautions taken by the PA in the West Bank and by Hamas in Gaza have been really impressive. They are well aware they don't have the medical facilities because again, Israel refuses to supply the Palestinians with a sufficiency of ventilators, of protective clothing, of medication, and the Palestinians know it, and they know they have limited hospital capacity, so they had to be pretty careful about public behavior, and they succeeded really in large part because the numbers I'm quoting could have been very, very much larger. So I think we need to acknowledge that and credit them for it. The irony here is that Israel is not only behaving in a criminal and in an illegal way, it's also a stupid way to do things. If one knows anything about epidemiology and about the way viruses spread, one knows immediately that borders, lines, and so on are meaningless. Now, even with the reduction in Palestinian labor from the occupied territories into Israel, even with that, thousands of Palestinian workers cross over into Israel every day and do jobs for Israelis. Right. They are a source of infection. I mean, it's just completely stupid that they deny them. But the overall point that I wish people would take from this is, first of all, never to accept what Israel says, because almost certainly one finds it's a tissue of lies and infection. Take the legal argument. We know that the occupied territories are subject to the Geneva Convention, and particularly the fourth, to do with healthcare, and that the occupying power has the responsibility, the legal responsibility, to provide healthcare amongst which vaccinations are very important. Now, the Israeli argument is that the Oslo Agreement of 1993 gave the Palestinian Authority the responsibility for the health care of the population. And you know, if you look at it at first sight and you read what the Oslo Accord says superficially, and it seems to be plausible, but of course it's not, because you look very carefully, you'll see that the things that it does not apply to are vaccinations of this order of this magnitude. It might talk about measles or something like this, but not this kind of epidemic. So it's nonsense. The whole thing is nonsense. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take up too much time because I hope somebody will ask me a question, but I just wanted to say that, honestly, at the end of the day, the case against Israel is proven over and over again. This is an apartheid state, which is a criminal state which has committed countless crimes against the Palestinian people. But the question is not whether it has done that. It has evidently done it. The question is, why do people accept this from Israel? Yeah. Why is Israel allowed the impunity that it is? In my mind, that is the three key question about everything to do with Israel.
Yeah, may I add some points to the... Yeah, thank you, Rada, for the excellent point. And just want to add that, you know, it's not just the New York Times or the Washington Post that were celebrating Israel. Even medical journals, you know, like The Lancet, when The Lancet Palestinian Health Alliance published a paper, an opinion saying that Israel has the obligation and the duty to vaccinate Palestinians, they published a really, just only can call it ridiculous paper by some Israeli authors saying that, Israel has no more duty to vaccinate Palestinians than England has to vaccinate Irish, and that ironically Israel has vaccinated more and Israel has vaccinated more Arabs than any other Arab state, Gaza Strip, instead of investing in the military budget, Israeli critiquing Gaza of overspending on military They should look for the healthcare system. So all of that is only being allowed to be celebrated. It is exactly, you know, similar to, I was looking, like you had similar pieces where apartheid South Africa was doing the same claims that, you know, Africans in apartheid South Africa have better outcomes health-wise than Africans in other countries. So the problem is not apartheid itself, but we should invest in South Africa or so on. So that's a point. But another thing then...
Before the dawn of limited self-government in Northern Ireland, Britain did have responsibility to vaccinate the Irish in Northern Ireland, in the part of Ireland that it's still occupied. It absolutely did have a responsibility to do that.
Yeah, so I wrote a response to that with an Irish lawyer. We hope it gets published, so we'll see how they do that. But and on another point, yeah, you know, Israel tried to be the leader in also vaccinating non-citizens. So it published that it will start vaccinating asylum seekers, refugees, so on, but not Palestinians. So, you know, it would say, and it clearly said that by the Ministry of Health that it would vaccinate, you know, you had this asylum seekers from Eritrea, Africa, not even like people without status. Refugees, asylum seekers, foreign workers, but not Palestinians. And then later on, after a few appeals by human rights groups, it said, okay, so people who, Palestinian workers who work in the settlements or in Israel can get vaccinated, you know, but like, I will vaccinate you only if I can exploit you, right? So you don't infect me. So it's a very twisted, really, logic of like hierarchies of human value, basically, right?
Yeah.
And also inside Israel, we need to know that the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are 20%, have way less vaccination rate than the Jewish population, also due to lack of access to healthcare. So where the vaccination center were stated in the beginning, now they're more spread out. But also because of lack of educating and hesitancy, right? So marginalized group really have a mistrust in systems and medical systems. They have vaccine hesitancy. We see it also in the Black community in the US, where you know the more hardly hit communities are more hesitant to get vaccinated.
Yeah, and in the UK too, Black people, you know, a lot of Black people don't trust the authorities for, you know, historical
For a good reason.
So it's very interesting. It's very interesting to hear that the same applies to Palestinian citizens of Israel, and I've heard within East Jerusalem as well.
As well, and of course, some of the communities are unrecognized. So if you look at the Naqab, the desert, most of the a lot of the Bedouin citizens in the Naqab live in unauthorized and unrecognized villages where they don't have any healthcare infrastructure. So and instead of reaching out to them, you know, Israel just doesn't do that.
May I make a please?
Yeah.
Because Osama points to quite rightly to the Lancet. I think you'll find, Osama, that it's the Lancet specifically that has done this. And there is a very good reason for that. The editor of the Lancet was put through the most grueling, the cruelest kind of reactions from the Zionists because he allowed, I know this story very well, it's very sad. He allowed the publication of a letter decrying the 2014 assault on Gaza, signed by quite a number of doctors. For that, the Israelis were after him. And he was invited to Israel. He was given the treatment. Since that time, he has been too intimidated to not to toe the line, because they got eventually to the publishers of the Lancet, who there was a threat to dismiss him from his post. So it's interesting that you mentioned that, but that, believe me, is the reason for why you saw that in the Lancet.
A few minutes left, you have to jump on another panel. So I just wanted to get your final thoughts on the time right now and how critical it is for...
I can stay for a bit more. So
oh, okay, good. Good. If you could talk maybe about just like, how critical it is right now
for international law to be followed in all aspects of, you know, Israel's colonialism, obviously, but specifically around the vaccination program, and we see, you know, in Gaza, just the deliberate deterioration of the healthcare sector because of Israel's violence and colonialism. How are physicians even able to address COVID under, you know, the confinement of Gaza right now?
I've had the opportunity to work also in healthcare in Israel, in the West Bank and in Gaza, to volunteer in mobile clinic in the West Bank and Gaza, so I can kind of have an image. And I think in the occupied Palestinian territory, we need to remember we haven't seen the pandemic started later. I think we haven't seen the peak of it by now. And if in the beginning people were really careful, and really the PA did and Hamas did a good job in trying to curb the numbers, but you know the economical situation is so hard that you can't simply and people cannot, these are not jobs that people are working from home with the internet and so on, and the schools are not equipped with the also all the digital equipment, we haven't seen the peak, I think, of the pandemic. It also hit much later than it did in the US and in Israel. And we need to remember two protective factors. Like, they are paradoxically, the Palestinian population is way younger than the Israeli or general Western population. And we know that COVID hits much more or kills much more elderly population. And that might explain why the numbers are yet, you know, not that catastrophic. But still, if we do, we need to do age adjustment to the Israelis, and that it doesn't have nursery houses, so elderly residences. And that was some of the hot spots, you know, in New York and in other Western cities. So I definitely think we haven't seen the worst. The worst is yet to come. We can see it with an alarming number of positive tests coming. Although you have a limited number of testing is quite highly positive. So it's very and it's a much more morbid society. You know, if in the US people are always talking about pre-existing condition, in Palestine we can generally talk about occupation as a pre-existing condition that makes the entire community has much more diabetes and hypertension and heart diseases and lots of other and much more higher percentage of smoking. So it's practically virtually impossible to practice a healthy lifestyle if you are living in a refugee camp, you know. And of course, there's a class element if you're not wealthy, and so on. So I think we might see an alarming number in the future, in the near future, and that's why it's very urgent to try to get the vaccine. And we know that the vaccine Israel has more vaccination than it needs now, and it's trying to distribute vaccines based on these political alliances and political gains to Guatemala or Honduras or different countries. And that is absolutely ridiculous. So it should be definitely held accountable. Each moment is precious. And we can think about any workers. You're talking about communities that are large families in small houses in crowded cities with no healthcare infrastructure, without a lot of abilities to do social distancing, and without without proper water sanitation and hygiene, especially in Gaza. So if you can't practice the preventive measures, you need the vaccination as quick as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ghada, what are your thoughts on where we go from here, and how, you know, people listening to this or watching this, are rightly outraged? What can ordinary citizens do at this point?
Yeah, good question. You know, one would have thought that Israel had reached the bottom in terms of the outrageous things that it's done to the Palestinians. But every time Israel takes me by surprise, there is still a new low to get to. And my view is that this behavior over a pandemic which has frightened the whole world, this behavior is so unconscionable that I would have thought that people should have been totally outraged by it. And the fact that this outrage is not expressing itself except by the usual suspects is really very disheartening, is all I can say. Nevertheless, we know what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a deeply criminal state. And I never mince my words about this, because if you want to do something about it, you have to spell it out and you have to tell it like it is. This is a deeply criminal state, which should never be allowed to get away with this. It's not only accountable, it's punishable. It has to be punished for the things that it's done. Now, in order to bring that about, it seems to me that people, first of all, must let the scales fall from their eyes. Every time Israel says anything or does anything, they must understand that this is a political act designed to boost the privileges of one particular group of people, Jewish people, at the expense of everybody else. So they've got to understand that, that is what motivates Israel. Secondly, that it behaves above the law and outside the law, and that is not acceptable for any of us. And thirdly, that the way to deal with all this has to be through action. It can't be through just disapproval and talking and shouting, and it's not going to work. You have to act, and the purpose of acting is to make Israel into the outlaw that it is, recognized by the whole world. It has to be made into a pariah, exactly as happened with South Africa. Great model for us to follow, and I'm very happy to say we already are, because we have a thriving, successful BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And I urge everybody who wants to do something to start off at least with joining the movement and working hard for that, and every other way they can think to publicize, expose this criminal state for what it is, they should consider, with all the representatives of authority, of government at their disposal.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a perfect way to end this discussion. I am so grateful for the work that you both do, Dr. Khada Karmi, physician, writer, author, scholar, and Dr. Osama Tanous, physician, pediatrician, and public health writer and scholar as well. Thank you both so much for joining us on the Electronic Intifada podcast. And we'll have links to your most recent work up on the podcast post that accompanies this. Asa, did you want to say anything else?
Well, thank you very much for both being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Israel, tens of thousands of people took to the streets Saturday for some of the largest protests yet against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ahead of Tuesday's election.
We are here to protest against Netanyahu and his corrupted government. This is our last chance before the election. We want everyone to come and vote to change, vote to exchange this government.
Israel's heading into its fourth election in 2 years amidst Netanyahu's ongoing corruption trial. Protesters initially condemned the government response to the pandemic, but Netanyahu is hoping Israel's rapid rollout of vaccines will help secure his win. In other news from the region, Israeli troops fatally shot a Palestinian man, 42-year-old Ataf Yusuf Hanaysha, on Friday during protests against illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
I'm Sam.
I'm David.
And this is TRAFE.
Welcome to TRAFE, the only Jewish podcast that's considering whether to complain to WNYC about use of the term shiesty in their ad copy.
You played it for me earlier today, David, and I am in favor of doing that.
But putting that immediately aside, we have a really great show lined up for everybody today. A whole episode focused on an interview we did with Irina Clapfish.
Yes. Irina is a writer, a poet, an activist, a lesbian feminist, a teacher, a researcher, and a really wonderful person.
Yeah. And, you know, Irina was born in the Warsaw Ghetto to Bundist parents. And following up on the suite we just did about the Jewish labor Bund, it was a nice opportunity to talk a bit with Irina about the Bund as well.
And before we get any further here, David, I think it's important to mention the fact that this was recorded about a year and a half ago.
Yes. This is an interview that we, I think, took us about 3 years to set up. many failed attempts at, you know, just technical problems, trying to send people to Irina's house with a microphone. Didn't quite work out. But then Irina actually ended up having plans to be about an hour and a half away from where we live, and we were able to meet up and spend a few hours together.
And I mean, I think you might be burying the lead a little bit here by not mentioning the fact that this interview took place at Klez Canada.
Oh, yeah. So for people who aren't familiar, Klez Canada is this week-long klezmer music and sort of Yiddish cultural festival or retreat that happens at this Jewish campground in the Laurentians, just about an hour away from Montreal. I think it's been happening for over 25 years now. And so Irina was there doing a few workshops and participating in the retreat.
Yeah, we talked about Clescan a little bit in the interview. What we didn't talk about, David, is the fact that I was a summer camper at Camp Inebrith, where Clez Canada takes place about 20 years ago.
Yes, although no endorsement of Camp Inebrith on this podcast.
They'll have to pay you, right, David?
Waiting for that check. No, we wouldn't take that money.
So that's your episode of TRAFE for the 11th of Adar, 5781.
I'm Irina Klepfisch, and I'm a writer, a poet. I just retired from teaching Jewish women's studies at Barnard College for 22 years, and I'm here at Clez Canada. I just gave two courses. I gave a poetry creative writing workshop, and I gave a little mini course on early Yiddish women writers in America.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So we're actually just finishing up a series on the Jewish Labor Bund. And so I thought we could maybe start by talking about the conference you helped organize in New York City last October. It was commemorating the 120th anniversary of the founding of the Bund. What was the experience like organizing that and also attending it?
Well, it was a kind of a labor of love for me, because I was raised by Bundists, people who were extremely active in interwar Poland before the war, and all of them were Holocaust survivors. And I feel, an enormous debt to the Bund. So there was some talk among children of Bundists, most of them, in fact, younger than me, because they were born after the war, maybe like 10 years or so. I was interested in participating. And I also was coming off a period where I'd been really totally inactive in terms of activism. I mean, I was continuing teaching, but I had family obligations and I couldn't really be active. And I was now able to do it. And so I very much wanted to be involved in it. It was sort of my way, I think, of paying tribute to the Bund and what I feel I'm indebted to from it and from the people that I knew who taught me about the Bund, rather indirectly, actually, because I never really had formal lessons. And some of the people that were involved in organizing were Hemshech, ex-Hemshech people. It was a camp that was organized by these Bundists. I think it started in 1958. By 1958, I was entering college, so I was too old for it. But they got a real grounding in it. I mean, they got, you know, lectures and whatever, and they reenacted, in fact, many things from Skiff and Zukunft that they had in Europe. I never had that experience. And my experience was a very vicarious experience. I kind of eavesdropped on my mother's friends. I loved listening to them. It's sort of interesting. I read somewhere that sometimes a catastrophe like erases your memory of everything but the catastrophe itself. And though the Holocaust was very much memorialized and very much in the consciousness of these people, so was it their life before the war. It was not something that was buried. And I was very, I was very taken with sort of the loyalty and the energy and the commitment and the clear-eyed way they looked at things and the clear-eyed way that they looked at Jews. They weren't sentimental in a certain way, but they were very committed to improving Jewish life. It was very, I don't know quite what drew me as a child, because I didn't start really hearing it until I came to the United States, and that was when I was 8. So that kind of continued for about the next 10 years. And so it was really by almost osmosis, kind of, and was learning about how they lived, what they did. It always sounded extremely energetic and quite, quite wonderful, and I loved the engagement of it.
What was the turnout like to that?
It was very. I mean, filled. I think the auditorium is 400, and there were people out. They video it so that people in the lobby can see it, and I think it was live streamed as well, and that they had tons and tons of people for it. So, it was a very gratifying. And we worked really hard on it, and we also did I send you the commemorative book? Did you see the commemorative book? Yeah. So I worked with Danny Sawyer on that. He's an academic history person who teaches Jewish history at Fordham University, and we worked together on that. And that was also a wonderful. I mean, it's a difficult experience. We were under enormous pressure to get it done by exactly October. I mean, it was. In fact, it was sort of a nightmare. But it was definitely a labor of love on my part, and I think on Danny's as well. And I just felt it was something I wanted to pay tribute to.
Over the years, you've also been a part of different memorials and commemorations of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. I'm wondering if you could talk briefly about your family, who were members of the Bund in Poland and who participated in the uprising.
Well, my father's family, my grandparents, were really from they were from the first, almost the first generation of Bundists. My father, my grandfather, Yankov Klepfisch, came from a Hasidic family, and he broke with them. So as an adult already, he was a Bundist. And he was probably born, I would imagine, like around 1880, maybe 85. So he was at the very beginning. My grandmother, his wife, Miriam Solomon, and she and at least one sibling were very much Bundist. One of her sisters was married to a well-known Bundist, Victor Schulman, Gutta Schulman. So that was a Bundist family. My mother's family, I don't know what her parents were, if anything, but it was a large family. It was six children, and as I understand it, they were totally split. Two, I think, Bundists, two communists, and two Zionists, or something like that. And my mother was in the Zionist camp when she met my father, and she switched. they met on a skiing trip in Zakopane, which was a place where people went to both in the summer and the winter. A lot of Zionists and socialists, like Bundist organizations, would take their people for sports, competitions, the Maccabee games, and stuff like that. My mother was, her father died. Her father was a watchmaker. They didn't have very much money. And when he died, she had to go to work, and she was 12. She was very literary minded. And the important thing that before she stopped school, her older siblings were very insistent, apparently, that she not go to a Volksschule. They wanted her to know Polish. And it was a really important element in her survival. It's not the only element, but it was certainly an important element in that she had impeccable Polish. She didn't have any accent. She spoke like a Pole, like a Christian Pole. And so when they married, she became a kind of Bundist, so that during the war, he was part of the underground, and he had a significant connection with the PPS, the Polish Socialist Party. My aunt, his sister, Aunt Gina, had her best friend was a Polish woman, young woman, who was in the PPS, and it was partly because of that that he ended up having some important contacts with the PPS. It didn't solve the problem, but it was a contact that was important. And Marysia, the friend, and her sister, they helped my mother and they helped my father during the war, and they were recognized as righteous Gentiles. I met Marysia in 1983, which was very thrilling for me. So the socialist and the Bundist ideas were very much in that. But, you know, I'm born during the war, so the war is already